Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And listen, we know there is a lot happening right now, and we are feeling it right along with you. You could not look more than 5 feet in front of you this weekend without some pretty rough news hitting you in the face, but we got you. We're going to stay focused. We're going to get through it together, and we're going to find out what is behind some of these big events. That's going to happen all this week. But we've got a lot to get to today, and we're going to begin with the urgent situation in Haiti. Early Saturday morning, a powerful earthquake struck Haiti, registering a magnitude of 7.2. This quake occurred on the same fault line and was even larger than the 2010 quake, which killed 300,000 Haitians. Because Saturday's quake was centered about 50 miles farther west from the urban center of the capital city, Port-au-Prince, the death toll is expected to be lower than in 2010. However, by Monday morning, more than 1,200 people were confirmed dead, and it is expected that that death toll will rise. With nearly 6,000 injured, local hospitals are overwhelmed, and thousands more are feared trapped beneath rubble and ruined buildings. The disaster comes just 1 month after the assassination of Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, which has left the nation's governance on insecure footing amid speculation about the responsible parties. All this amidst a global pandemic. Until very recently, Haiti was, according to UNICEF, quote, the only country in the Americas without a single dose of COVID-19 vaccine. The first vaccine shipment arrived in Haiti on July 14th. And given the significant damage to infrastructure caused by Saturday's earthquake, the pandemic is likely to enter a dangerous new phase in Haiti. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Grace, which was downgraded to a tropical depression, is set to bring storms to Haiti early this week. And remember, all this is happening in a nation less than 700 miles from Miami. Joining me now is Gary Pierre-Pierre, editor-in-chief of the Haitian Times. Gary, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me.
First, may I just ask you about your family, friends, loved ones in the wake of Saturday's quake?
Well, thanks for asking. Everyone is fine as far as I know. Obviously, as you mentioned in your intro, that region is not as populated as Port-au-Prince. And so people were able, and people had some experience from 11 years ago, and they knew that they shouldn't stay inside the building. So a lot of people left buildings and into safety. So that was good news, if we can find any good news in this scenario.
Really? Initially on Saturday, there were tsunami warnings. I believe those are all over now. But what about the aftershocks? Are you still expecting those?
Yes, they're still coming. And that's just like typical. In 2010, it was the same thing. And we call them aftershocks, but they're pretty big shocks, you know, 5.6, you know, and stuff like that. That's still pretty strong quake, the aftershocks.
Now, what are you hearing from people who are in the affected area about the conditions?
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible. People, the hospitals, such as they were, overrun. The rescue mission, so far as we know, has been slow. We haven't seen much on the ground, according to our reporters. People have food insecurity. They have shelter insecurity. People are afraid to sleep inside. So you have a lot of people basically sleeping outside because of the aftershock, as you mentioned. So that's as scary as the original quake itself.
As you talk about sort of a lack of action on the ground at the moment, can you connect that? You know, obviously, you and I have been talking for the past month several times about the political instability in Haiti. And I'm just kind of wondering the ways that that's playing out in this moment of crisis.
Well, absolutely. It's playing out badly, as expected. This is a very weak government. It was just installed a few weeks ago, and it doesn't have legitimacy. There's contention around the legitimacy of the prime minister. And so the civil and society is not supporting it. It's just a mess. I mean, that's a very blunt way to put it. They're not up to speed. They don't have the equipment. First of all, we must admit that. In the last decade, the Haitian government have not taken steps to mitigate the impact of a earthquake. And so now we're seeing the result of it because we don't know what the final number will be. But one thing I can tell you is that it'll be more than it should have been had the government taking actions to make sure that codes are respected and some buildings are upgraded to code. And none of that was done, actually.
As we've talked about before, there is this issue of the governance actually happening by the gangs. And, you know, you sort of walked me through some of what that's meant in, you know, presumably normal times. What might that mean for Haitian citizens now?
Well, the good news is, Melissa, that the government was able to broker a truce deal with the gangs. The controls, the artery that gets you from Port-au-Prince to the southern part where the earthquake epicenter was. And so aid and people are able to cross that artery and get to the affected area and so on. So the government was able to work with the gangs and allow them to pass. So this is the absurdity of the situation. I'm saying this and not to say, it's kind of like, okay, so the government had to negotiate with the gang members to allow people to go through it. This is really, you know, next level stuff.
As you're starting to think here about aid, we know that the USAID is sending assistance. We know that undoubtedly international aid agencies are going to begin to come in. And I'm just wondering if you think that these international actors have really learned anything from the failures and the abuses following the 2010 earthquake. You know, I'm thinking here specifically of the cholera outbreak, which was, you know, only very recently addressed forthrightly by the international community in terms of how UN peacekeepers were part of it. And I'm also thinking a little bit here about UN soldiers and their fathering and abandoning of children.
Well, yeah, that's a whole lot. I mean, we could have a what the UN did in Haiti. But to your first point about the international community's response, I think this time it will be measured. It will be better done, if you will. Even the Haitian government, such as it is aware of the problems that happened the last time, of the waste, because that's what it was. It was too much money pouring in and people just didn't know how to do with it. And a lot of it was misspent, if downright stolen. And so everybody is leery about this. In fact, one of the things that people have been asking me at the Haitian Times is like, what organization should they donate to? And I've been very cautious so far as to what we're recommending, because we're not sure who's going to be present in Haiti. I mean, USAID is the American government's official aid organization. And Samantha Power, who is the director, administrator of the USAID, I said that help is on its way. They're bringing all the equipment needed because to rescue people, because right now we're still in the rescue stage right now, that, you know, we need to save as many lives as possible and make sure that those who are alive have the proper nutrition and water and medical care, which is not forthcoming right now. There are no significant medical aid coming in. I know that there are a lot of folks in the United States, in the diaspora, who are waiting to go down to help with medical missions. But so, that's not being organized rapidly enough, as I see it, because I know that the crucial early days are important, and I don't know, because I'm not on the ground, and my reporters, our reporters are saying they're not seeing the international community's presence like we did 11 years ago. And so I'm a little bit concerned about what that is going to look like.
You absolutely anticipated precisely where I was going to go next, because I know that listeners will be, you know, wanting to do something, and sometimes doing is worse than doing nothing. But Naomi Osaka tweeted over the weekend that it really hurts to see all the devastation going on in Haiti. I feel like we can't catch a break. I'm about to play a tournament this week, and I'll give all the prize money to relief efforts for Haiti. I know our ancestors' blood is strong. We'll keep rising. And yet, as I read that, I thought, okay, but where? Like, where would the money go from either folks like Naomi Osaka or others, towards trying to assist?
Well, we'll wait and see, because after a rescue mission, you have other needs that will be necessary. There's food, there's shelter, because right now tents are needed, almost like camping gears are needed for people. So there's going to be a need for all kinds of stuff. So what I would say to Naomi, who I admire for grace, for love of a country that she's been to a few times, but it's still in her blood. She has really embraced her culture, part of her culture, which is Japanese and American at the same time. Mm-hmm. But she has really risen to the occasion in regards to Haiti. So there are many people like that. And I think that, you know, we should wait and see where the needs are before we send money. You know, we should open a wallet, but wait until to be directed to the right organizations, because one of the organizations that people are saying absolutely not to donate to is the International Red Cross, because the money doesn't necessarily go to the needy. And the experience last time was disastrous, even for the Red Cross. They admitted that they were not equipped to do development work, and they were given money for development work. Where Red Cross is disaster relief in the moment. And what happens next, it's not their belly week. But last time they were giving a lot of money, a lot more money than they knew what to do with, frankly. And one thing I want to say, Melissa, is that when I think about Haiti, I have to think about this old song. If it wasn't for bad luck, Haiti would not have any luck at all.
And I hope, Gary, that you will continue to come back and talk with us. We're not going to take our eyes off of this because, again, there are these multiple compounding disasters happening simultaneously. Gary Pierre-Pierre, editor-in-chief of the Haitian Times, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
On Thursday, the U.S. Census Bureau released its latest round of data, and the results are fascinating. I mean, when is census data not fascinating, right? But these 2020 numbers really serve up some demographic drama. Without going too far down the statistical rabbit hole, here are the big takeaways. Takeaway one, our population growth has slowed. The census shows the slowest population growth since the Depression. Takeaway two, we are an aging nation. Declining birth rates mean the overall share of children has declined while the median age of adults has risen. Okay, boomers. Takeaway three, el futuro es Latino. Nearly half of the U.S. population growth occurred among Hispanics. And finally, takeaway four, white folks are so last decade. I mean, not only did the proportion of non-Hispanic white Americans drop below 60% for the first time, but the actual number of white Americans declined as well by nearly 5 million people. But listen, before y'all start planning to put Harriet Tubman on the 20 and turning the 100 into a Cesar Chavez C-note, let's have a little conversation about whether greater numbers really translate into greater power. Here to help us debunk the demographics are destiny trope and really understand how racial communities become representational tools are Aisha Mills, host of Amplified on BNC. Aisha, welcome to The Takeaway.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
And David Daley, author of Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, David, so you heard my four big takeaways from the census data. Are there other big takeaways that I've missed here?
No, I think you have your finger on exactly the right takeaways. And what is so crucial about these takeaways is that the census data does more than tell us who we are as a nation. It is the starting gun for redistricting. The decennial process by which congressional and state legislative lines around the country are redrawn. What we see in the census data is that we are becoming increasingly a diverse and multiracial nation. The question is, after this redistricting process, will we be a multiracial democracy? And what stands in the way of that, of course, is that as the population is moving south and west towards states like North Carolina and Georgia, Texas, Florida, Arizona, and this growth is fueled by Hispanic and Asian and Black populations, it is running into Republican control of redistricting in all of those states. And we know from what we've seen over the last decade, how determined Republicans have been to maintain power in those states. We see the 400 voter suppression bills that have been coming out of state legislatures around the country. And so this is the collision. It's a collision between where populations are going and who controls the political power and lines in all of those states. And it becomes a question of whether you can use gerrymandering essentially to defy demographic trends.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for helping us understand the difference between demographics, right? Showing us sort of who we are versus what people call destiny or the political power piece, sort of who actually gets to rule. So Aisha, are you at all surprised by some of these numbers? I have to say, we've spent so much, you know, so many advocates have spent so much of 2020 trying to make sure that people of color actually returned those census forms that we certainly thought there was going to be an undercount there. So I have to say, I was a little surprised to find that it was white folks who were down in the numbers.
Yeah, the 2020 census count, bizarrely, to me, is far more accurate than we all expected it to be, for sure. But the trends are, you have been predicted for decades at this point. I remember over a decade ago, I was actually a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we had a program called Progress 2020, looking at what would happen when people of color were the majority in this nation. We call it the rising American electorate or the new American majority. But this idea that there is a browning of America, at one point it was, you know, it was 2050, then it's, you know, somewhere around 2025. I mean, the date kept changing. But the trend is clear. And everything that we're talking about right now about how power moves with the people, through the people or not, is really going to be the conundrum of the next several generations, I believe, as someone who has been on the ground in electoral politics for the last 20 years, because simply having more Black folks or, and frankly, Black people, you know, are staying relatively static. We're moving to different parts of the country, but in relative to our numbers, we're not the huge growth, right? Like you said, it's the Latinx community, it's the Asian community. Having more people of color doesn't necessarily mean that the politics change right away. And so I think deeply and have been working on how do we get that representation. Representation matters, but how do we make sure we have a reflective democracy, even as we have a multicultural democracy? And that's the hard part, because that's really about competition, fights and battles and organizing on the ground, which is, you know, not something that we can blink and do. And redistricting, voter suppression, all of that stymies it intentionally, because it is, you know, we have people in place in power in a lot of these southern states who really want to preserve white nationalism and white supremacy as the framework for our democracy. That is always what we're fighting and pushing against. And I just want to add that white people, please be reminded that you have to be a part of the solution too, because white nationalism serves no one. So when we allow those lines to be drawn in a way that is preserving a minority power, it's actually hurting everybody.
So David, you name checked some of the places where they're going to be the big redistricting battles, but I'm wondering, the one place where there aren't ever redistricting battles is the U.S. Senate, right? Every state gets two. And it feels like that is probably the least representative body, because every state gets two, but population isn't distributed that way.
I think that's exactly right. And what we're heading towards is by the middle of the next decade, about 30% of the population in this country is going to live in 15 states, which means they'll have 30 senators. And those living in the parts of the country that are effectively shrinking, these smaller rural states, will have 70 U.S. senators. What we're really facing here is baked in structural rule by part of the population that is whiter, more rural, more conservative.
When we do redistricting in 2021, if we have not changed the electorate, especially in the South, we will have a majority-minority population that is governed by a minority-white conservative coalition. And that's the most dangerous precedent that we could possibly set for the South in the next 20 years.
That was Stacey Abrams back in 2014, apparently being a prophet. So Aisha, we just heard there Abrams, you know, in 2014, thinking about this idea of a South that is, you know, ruled in this upside down way. But this is certainly a part of American history. Is there something we can draw from our history about how to allow demographics to push us towards a more truly racial democracy?
You know, this is the foundation of our nation and really a backlash. Everyone should remember that we got here from somewhere. This is a backlash that we've seen throughout the South for, you know, 100 years. You know, during Reconstruction, we actually had an attempt to have more equal representation throughout the South. You had Black folks in the U.S. Senate and in Congress. People were, you know, leading towns. You had people, when you're able to vote, actually reflect and vote for people in their community. Obviously, you know, white supremacy didn't want that to happen. And as I listen to Stacey Abrams, I'm reminded that we actually haven't gone as far as we thought that we had. Sure, we have more people of color who hold office today than we ever had in history, but that is skewed. It is skewed in terms of what communities we represent. And so, you know, we've got a long way to go. And I think that that is always the message. Yes, things look better, but structurally, we're still in the same conundrum of white supremacist rule. And that is something that we've got to figure out how to address and deal with. And the only way we can is by recognizing that that is exactly how imbalanced our power is and doing something to fix it.
Now, David, I feel like data nerds like you and I are going to see those census numbers. We're going to dig in. We're going to play around on the charts. But we certainly cannot and should not expect the majority of the American population to do so, which means most folks are going to understand the census data through media. Reflect on media coverage a bit from the past few days. Are we getting it right in how we're talking about what these numbers are and what they mean?
That's a great question. And I think that there is more awareness of these questions of voting and representation in the mainstream media now than there has been in quite some time, and more awareness of the dangers of things like gerrymandering and voter suppression. When I wrote a book on the last redistricting cycle that was published in 2016, a lot of people said, well, you know, gerrymandering isn't that big of a deal. Really, it's the big sort. It's just the Democrats and are moving to, you know, blue cities and that they want to be around like-minded people. And Republicans simply live more scattered and more efficiently spread out. And that explains it. And we know that that simply is not the case now. And I think our media coverage has come a long way in reflecting that. But what I don't think we understand fully are the real existential dangers of this moment and just how close we are to this entrenched minority rule. I mean, after the 2018 elections, there were 59 million Americans living in a state in which one or both chambers of their state legislature were controlled by Republicans, even though Democrats in those states won more votes in that election. You have states like Wisconsin and North Carolina and Pennsylvania, competitive states where even when Democrats win hundreds of thousands of more votes for the state house, they are unable to win a majority of seats. And what we're facing in the 2022 midterms, Democrats hold a 5-seat advantage in the U.S. House. Now, they won 4.7 million more votes nationwide in 2020. When Republicans won about 4.4 million more votes in 2014, that equated to 247 seats. So Democrats already face a challenge there as a result of gerrymandering and geography. But now, when you factor in the fact that these lines are going to change in Texas, in Georgia, in North Carolina, in Florida, in Arizona, and who will be drawing them, you could have a situation, and I think we almost certainly will, in which if everybody voted the same way, you would have a huge majority of Americans favoring Democratic candidates, but a Republican majority in the U.S. House, a Republican Speaker of the U.S. House. And as we all know, the Speaker does not have to be a member. So the Speaker could be former President Trump.
Wait, okay. Excuse me, what?
The Speaker of the House does not need to be a member of the U.S. House. So if Republicans take the House, there is every possibility that they could elevate anybody of their choosing, perhaps even a certain former president.
Okay. That was, I learned something new in this moment. And I feel that we are definitely going to need some more time at some point. David Daley has me checking my passport and is the author of Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. And Aisha Mills is host of Amplified on BNC. I think I want to say thank you to both of you for being here, but that was a lot. Okay. Thank you both.
Anytime.
Thanks, yeah.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We've been discussing how the recent census data will affect how district lines are drawn for state legislators, city councils, Congress, and more. As redistricting gets underway, some marginalized groups are seeing it as an opportunity to increase political power. The Victory Fund, a national organization dedicated to electing LGBTQ people, is pushing to keep LGBTQ neighborhoods united as maps are redrawn, thereby strengthening collective voting power. For more on this, we're joined by Sean Malloy, Vice President of Political Programs at the LGBT Victory Fund. Sean, great to have you here.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So what is the We Belong Together campaign, and how did it get started?
Yeah, this is an opportunity for the LGBTQ community to ensure that our voices are heard as maps are redrawn following the census data that was just collected. We were inspired by some great successes in California, where Equality of California helped make sure LGBTQ communities had their district lines respect the actual voices of the people who live there. And that's led to great success. And so we're very excited to keep that going with our We Belong Together toolkit.
So help me understand this particular definition of LGBTQ communities, because when I think about LGBTQ communities, I think of identity communities, not necessarily geographic ones, right? In ways that, like, the historic realities of racial discrimination created housing patterns where you can, you know, you can plop down and see ethnic neighborhoods, you can see racialized neighborhoods. Is that also true for queer neighborhoods?
Yes, that's what we found when they did this work in California. And what we feel, what so many people feel in the neighborhoods in which they live and in many cities across the United States. And so we feel that those voices should be respected and certainly considered through this process.
Now, clearly, LGBTQ folk are not all in one political party. And in fact, perhaps the diversity is even greater among this particular identity community of interest than, for example, among African Americans who do tend to vote in much larger blocks towards, for example, the Democratic Party. So how does it work to think about drawing district lines respecting identity and communities of interest while also acknowledging that there might be some real partisan differences?
One of the things that we're working to do here is to make sure that people understand that there is a lack of data when it comes to LGBTQ people. And that has helped lead to us being underrepresented in a lot of aspects of government, including map making. And so one of the things that we're working to do with this project is to say we need to collect more data and we need to actually make sure LGBTQ people are accounted for so we can actually make those distinct determinations as we're able to do with other, you know, minority communities that are collected by the census. And so LGBTQ people do vote at an 80% plus clutch for Democrats and feel that they are helping make sure that LGBTQ equality becomes accomplished. And so we are very similar in that regard. And we think that these neighborhoods and their voting patterns actually will help showcase that.
Now, talk to me about sort of the balance between the identities of the representatives that you seek to elect. So if we think about, for example, Congressional Black Caucus districts, right, or those sort of CBC districts, it's always sort of a two-part goal, both a goal of electing more Black representatives and particular policy issues that are on the agenda. So talk to me a little bit about sort of electing more LGBTQ politicians, representatives, and about what some of the policy issues are.
Yeah, well, you know, LGBTQ Victory Fund is all about getting LGBT people elected and those elected officials acting not only for their communities, but to help make sure that LGBTQ equality is achieved. And we think that when these people are elected from these districts, we know that they're actually doing that. We also know that these districts are diverse. We know that LGBTQ people come in all shapes and sizes across every demographic. And so we are able to actually draw districts in California last cycle. There was an LGBTQ Latino propensity district. And we think that there's potential for other communities like that around the country that would actually align with some of the other goals that come from making sure other minority communities are represented.
Sean Malloy is the Vice President of Political Programs at the Victory Fund. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last week, a new show titled Reservation Dogs premiered on FX and Hulu. Here's how Shay Vassar, a film and television critic and citizen of the Cherokee Nation, describes it.
It's focused around four Indigenous teenagers in a small town in Oklahoma, and they are just getting into shenanigans, some legal, some illegal, and their hope is to get enough money to make it out to California, to escape this small community and make it into the big sunny world of California.
Co-created by Sterling Harjo and Taika Waititi, all of the stars, writers, and directors of the show are Indigenous. Now, I wish I could say this has all been done before, but we're talking about Hollywood here. It's an industry that for over a century has cast white actors as Indigenous characters. And almost the entire genre of the Western is dependent on the villainization and erasure of Indigenous tribes. And that's why Reservation Dogs and its relatable characters feel so significant. Here's a scene from last week's premiere featuring DeFaro Wunantai as Bear and Devery Jacobs as Alora.
Don't we all feel bad?
Bad about what?
Just all the crimes we do, you know? Like the driver, you really ruined that guy's life. For real. I mean, right now they're probably cutting off his legs from the diabetes we gave him. What if we're the bad guys here, you know? I think we should give the money back.
Who cares about that old man? It's dog eat dog here. We got that money fair and square.
Fair and square? Alora, we stole a damn truck.
I spoke with Shay Vassar about what stood out to her when she watched Reservation Dogs and who might be the intended audience for the show.
It's probably for teenagers as well as adults. I mean, they curse, they're a little rugged, but that's also kind of part of the Indigenous teenage experience. It is very coming of age, especially because the four teenagers seem to vary in the point that they're at during their teenage years, where you have Cheese, who is the youngest, I would assume maybe 13, 14, 15, more in that realm. And he's just pure innocence compared to, say, Willie Jack, who might be younger, but she is tough. She is able to climb up and steal copper wire, hijack cars, you know, so it really varies in the age, which makes it so unique.
Talk to me about the ways in which this feels familiar or unique to things that we've seen before, especially in that it centers on Indigenous teen characters.
Yeah, I really love that there is both familiarity and what teenagers like. I mean, Bear is always wearing shirts with David Bowie or other bands that are generational, right? Like someone like David Bowie is not specific to just the era that he came out, also because he covered so many different eras, but he's kind of like a lifelong figure. And in that same way, it is able to cross over from Indigenous teenage experience to just general teenage experience, which shows that Native teenagers are kids too. We, you know, I, as a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, it's something that I constantly tell people is, you know, we're Native when we're doing ceremony, but we're also Native when we're sitting around binging a television show. That is kind of what Reservation Dogs is showing, while also showing the specifics of what that experience looks like culturally.
Now, of course, not all Indigenous people live on reservation. You know, folks live in multiple different kinds of settings. And I know that there can be critiques around this. This, you know, was certainly part of like an emergence of a Black urban youth sort of film and television in the 1990s, where it was like, hey, yeah, but, you know, actually everyone doesn't live in the middle of New York City and everyone isn't coping right with these specific challenges. And yet it was also, there was something also very joyful about being able to see represented something we had not previously. So talk to me a little bit about the reservation aspect of this narrative.
So one thing that is very specific to the Oklahoma experience is this idea, especially when it comes to the five tribes, which are going to be the Muscogee Nation, Choctaw Nation, Seminole Nation, Cherokee Nation, and Chickasaw Nation. Those tribes for so long were not thought to have a quote unquote reservation. However, the Supreme Court recently, as of just last year, reaffirmed with the McGirt versus Oklahoma decision that these reservations that were supposedly disestablished during statehood were actually never completely gone. And so it's been, in a way, kind of like a reaffirming of what Native communities have known all along, is that Oklahoma reservations still exist. And of course, there are some like the Osage Reservation in Pawhuska that it does, like, and it has existed. However, when it comes to those specific and in other tribes within the state, that has been a really just different thing in the last year. Now, obviously, like you said, not all Native people live on reservations. And some of that is due to other government systems like the Relocation Act, which was purposely, the goal of that was to move Native people from states like Oklahoma, which a majority of the tribal communities that are there were already forced into, and send them to places like California, Seattle, some of these more urban areas in I believe the 1960s. So sometimes it's good to know that these urbanization of indigenous communities isn't just because we all woke up one day and decided to move. However, that is my story, you know, living in New York as a Native person. I've been here about 5 years. And since then, you know, I've been able to connect with other urban indigenous people. We are a diverse group. We all come from different backgrounds, and we're able to share our cultures with each other in an urban way. But I know that even my community here, we are so excited for Reservation Dogs because it looks like something we know either from our home or where we would go visit because that's where our aunties or our grannies lived. So it does capture a certain indigenous experience that even if you weren't, say, born and raised on a reservation, you know, majority of people know what that is pointing at and what that life is like.
Shay, I love the ways that you're capturing for us the multiple complexities of representation. Talk to me a little bit here about Sterling Harjo, who is a co-creator. And what did Sterling do prior to this show?
So Sterling is someone that I followed for a little bit. We've been mutuals on like Instagram, and I have friends that also worked on Reservation Dogs. You know, being from the area, the Tulsa area, I grew up with people that have been, you know, cinematographers and extras on his films, his documentaries, or help support him in other ways. So I've always been a couple degrees away from Sterling Harjo, which I always joke that most indigenous people in the film world were only 2 degrees away from Taika Waititi. So the fact that Sterling and Taika are good friends, it just kind of proves that that is very true. But Sterling has really fought for a place in this industry. You know, he started with, I mean, comedy with some of the people that are also major parts in Reservation Dogs. Their group was called the 1491s. And I mean, their sketches are hilarious.
Don't pay taxes. I don't pay them. There's no point. Don't drink tea. Tea comes from the Bahamas. We fought them for the right for you not to drink tea. Drink coffee. It comes from Oklahoma. We all know that.
Man, you ever wish veterans and elders would just shut the hell up?
This was, of course, in a time, or they really started in a time prior to the emergence of YouTube and all of that. They were just doing it for fun. But he also was at Sundance in one of their programs for Indigenous creators, and that's actually where he met Taika. And from that, he has created some short films, which he has one that is set in an Indian Health Services waiting room, and it feels very familiar to the second episode of Reservation Dogs. So what we see with Reservation Dogs is what Sterling has worked towards with everything. His exploration, both in a comedic sense, he's done documentaries that have looked at his own personal family connections. And I am just really happy to see someone that has continued to fight against this idea that Native content is not sellable, it's not going to be watched. And now he is proof that that rhetoric was wrong all along.
Can you say just one more word about Taika and whether or not you think FX would have greenlit the show without Taika's involvement?
Yeah, I mean, I think Taika is doing what we hope all allies do, which of course Taika is indigenous as well, but from, you know, a whole different part of the world. But Taika is, again, someone that has built up a specific area in this industry, a very hard industry to get into. And Taika is a pretty big name now. And so the fact that he is using his privilege and his power in order to create space for other narratives that need to be told is something that I hope continues within the industry. I mean, we hear all the time about just the gatekeeping in all aspects of the film and television world. And so it's refreshing to know that Taika created this opening, right, with his connections with FX. And now we have a Native American show available via Hulu. So that is so incredible. I know too, just because like I have talked with Sterling a little bit, and during a panel that I moderated, Sterling also mentioned the way that Taika opened that door. And then how Sterling continued to open that door for other filmmakers and creators, PAs, actors to fill in those spaces in the same way. I mean, the Lane Factor, who plays Cheese on the show, this is his first acting gig. And he is so perfect for the role. He's incredible. He might actually be my favorite of the Rez Dogs, the main four, but I don't want to get, you know, I don't like picking favorites.
Right. It also ends up, you know, if you pick favorites, you also pick fights with your readers.
No, so. Exactly. And especially because all four kind of capture a different personality you might know in a Native community. So I love that. But also we have like Tazba Chavez, who she got to direct her first episode of television. I mean, she was a writer on Rutherford Falls. She's done her own work. She has a beautiful short film about her experiences having a Native name in carpool situations like Uber and Lyft, and the conversations that has sparked. So to be able to see these connections in the way that more opportunities are being opened, it's like a waterfall effect. Taika opened the door, Sterling continued to open the door, and now that's going to continue to ripple throughout specifically the Indigenous filmmaking community, because that is something that is very specific to, even though there is a large and diverse group of cultures among Indigenous people, something that I've always found in common is that we are about community rather than the individual. And so this is just the practice of that.
Shay Vassar is a film and television critic and citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Shay, thanks so much for joining The Takeaway.
Yes, thanks, Melissa.
Well, that's the show, y'all. And listen, we know over the weekend, there was so much news. It was impossible to get it all into our hour-long show. But the plan is to get to all of those big stories during this week. So keep coming back and tuning in so you don't miss it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.